A cacophony of chirps and beeps erupts from her phone. In the bunk below her, Crystal has changed into baggy sweats. The matted teddy bear sits in the crook of her arm as she watches a Marvel movie on her phone, the soundtrack leaking out of her earbuds, tinny and shrill. I can hear blips of gunfire and the telltale crunch of fist hitting skull. On the other side of the cabin, Miranda reclines on the top bunk, now dressed in a tight tank top and black shorts so small they barely qualify to be called that. She holds her phone close to her face, doing a faux pout as she takes several pictures. "You shouldn't be using your phones," I say, even though I was guilty of doing the same thing earlier. "Save your batteries." Crystal tugs off her earbuds. "What else are we going to do?" "We could, you know, talk," I suggest. "You may find it hard to believe, but people actually did that before everyone spent all their time squinting at screens." "I saw you talking to Theo after dinner," Miranda says, her voice wavering between innocence and accusation. "Is he, like, your boyfriend?" "No, he's a..." I truly don't know what to call Theo. Several different labels apply. My friend? Not necessarily. One of my first crushes? Probably. The person I accused of doing something horrible to Vivian, Natalie, and Allison? Definitely. "He's an acquaintance," I say.
"Do you have a boyfriend?"
Sasha asks.
"Not at the moment."
I have plenty of friends who are boys, most of them gay or too socially awkward to consider a romantic relationship. When I do date someone, it's not for very long. A lot of men like the idea of being in a relationship with an artist, but few actually get used to the reality of the situation. The odd hours, the self-doubt, and stained hands that stink of oil paint more often than not. The last guy I dated, a dorky, cute accountant at a rival ad agency, managed to put up with it for 4 months before breaking things off. Lately, my romantic life has consisted of occasional dalliances with a French sculptor when he happens to be in the city on business. We meet for drinks, conversation, sex made more passionate by how infrequent it is.
"Then how do you know Theo?" Crystal says.
"From when I was a camper here."
Miranda latches onto this news like a shark biting into a baby seal. A wicked grin widens across her face and her eyes light up. It reminds me so much of Vivian that it causes a strange ache in my heart.
"So you were at Camp Nightingale before?" she says. "Must have been a long time ago."
Rather than be offended, I smile, impressed by the stealthiness of her insult. She's a sly one. Vivian would have loved her.
"It was," I say.
"Did you like it here?"
Sasha says, as bombastic music rises from her phone and exploding candy pieces reflect off the lenses of her glasses.
"At first, then not so much."
"Why did you come back?" Crystal asks.
"To make sure you girls have a better time than I did."
"What happened?"
Miranda says.
"Something horrible?"
She leans forward, her phone temporarily discarded as she waits for my answer. It gives me an idea.
"Phone's off," I say. "I mean it."
All three of them groan. Miranda's is the most dramatic, as she, like the others, switches off her phone. I sit cross-legged on the floor, my back pressed against the edge of my bunk. I pat the spaces on either side of me until the girls do the same.
"What are we doing?"
Sasha asks.
"Playing a game. It's called Two Truths and a Lie. You say three things about yourself. Two of them must be true. One is false. The rest of us have to guess the lie."
We played it a lot during my brief time in Dogwood, including the night of my arrival. The four of us were laying on our bunks in the darkness of the cabin, listening to nature's chorus of crickets and bullfrogs outside the window, when Vivian suddenly said,
"Two truths and a lie, ladies. I'll start."
She began to utter three statements, either assuming we already knew how the game was played or just not caring if we didn't.
1. I once met the president. His palm was sweaty.
2, my parents were going to get a divorce but then decided not to when my dad got elected. 3, once on vacation in Australia, I got pooped on by a koala. 3, Natalie said, you used it last year.
No, I didn't.
You totally did, Allison said. You told us a koala peed on you.
That's how it went every night. The four of us in the dark, sharing things we'd never reveal in the light of day. Constructing our lies so they'd sound real. It's how I learned that Natalie once kissed a field hockey teammate, and that Allison tried to sabotage a matinee of Les Miserables by spilling grape juice on her mother's costume 5 minutes before curtain. The game was Vivian's favorite. She said you could learn more about a person from their lies than their truths. At the time, I didn't believe her. I do now.
I'll start, Miranda says. 1, I once made out with an altar boy in the confessional during Christmas Mass. 2, I read 100 books a year, mostly mysteries. 3, I once threw up after riding the cyclone at Coney Island.
The 2nd one, Crystal says.
Definitely, Sasha adds.
Miranda pretends to be annoyed, even though I can tell she's secretly pleased with herself.
Just because I'm smoking hot doesn't make me illiterate. Hot girls read.
Then what's the lie?
Sasha says.
I'm not telling.
Miranda gives us an impish grin.
Let's just say I've never been to Coney Island, but I go to Mass all the time.
Crystal goes next, telling us that her favorite superhero is Spider-Man, that her middle name is also Crystal, although spelled with a C, and that she, too, threw up after riding the cyclone.
2nd one, we all say in unison.
Was it that obvious?
I'm sorry, Miranda says, but Crystal, no parent would be that cruel.
When it's time for her turn, Sasha nervously pushes her glasses higher onto her nose and wrinkles her brow in concentration. Clearly, she's not used to lying.
My favorite food is pizza, she says. That's 1. 2, my favorite animal is the pygmy hippopotamus. 3, I don't think I can do this. Lying's wrong, you guys.
It's okay, I tell her. Your honesty is noble.
She's lying, Miranda says.
Right, Sasha? The 3rd one is the lie.
Sasha shrugs broadly, feigning innocence.
I don't know. You'll have to wait and see.
Your turn, Emma, Crystal says. 2 truths and 1 lie.
I take a deep breath, stalling. Even though I knew this was coming, I can't think of suitable things to say. There's so much I could reveal about myself, so little I actually want to have exposed.
1, my favorite color is periwinkle blue, I announce.
2, I have been to the Louvre 2.
You still need to give us a 3rd one, Miranda says.
I stall some more, mulling the possibilities in my head, ultimately settling on something perched between fiction and fact. During the summer of my 13th year, I did something terrible.
Totally the 1st one, Miranda says, 2 nods of agreement from the others.
I mean, if you truly had done something terrible, you're not going to admit it during a game.
I smile, pretending that they're right. What none of them understand is that the point of the game isn't to fool others with a lie. The goal is to trick them by telling the truth. 15 years ago. My 2nd night at Camp Nightingale was as sleepless as the 1st, possibly worse. No electricity in the cabin meant no air conditioning, no fan, nothing to act as a shield against the late June heat. I awoke before dawn, sweaty and uncomfortable, a patch of warm moisture between my legs. When I dipped an index finger into my underwear to investigate, it came back stained with blood. I was seized with panic, unsure what to do. I knew about menstruation, of course. The girls in my class had been given the talk the year before, much to the relief of my mother, who was spared such awkwardness. We were told why it would happen, We were told how it would happen, but my gym teacher, kindly, clueless Miss Baxter, had neglected to tell us what to do when it happened. Ignorant and fearful, I crawled out of bed and awkwardly climbed the ladder to the bunk above mine, afraid to part my legs too much. Rather than ascend 1 foot at a time, I gripped the ladder's sides and lifted both feet up each rung in quick, bunk-shaking hops. By the time I reached the top, Vivian was already half awake. Her eyes fluttered beneath a swath of blonde hair that covered her face like a veil. "What the hell are you doing?"
"I'm bleeding," I whispered.
"What?"
"I'm bleeding," I said again, stressing the second word as much as I could.
"Then go get a Band-Aid."
"It's between my legs."
Vivian's eyes opened fully as she swiped the hair from her face. "You mean..." I nodded. "Is this your first time?"
"Yes."
"Fuck," she sighed, partly out of annoyance and partly out of pity. "Come on, there are tampons in the latrine." I followed Vivian outside, waddling like a duck down the mulch-covered path. At one point, she glanced back at me and said, "Quit walking like that, you look like an idiot." Inside the latrine, Vivian hit the light switch by the door and led me to the nearest stall. Along the way, she grabbed a tampon from the dispenser attached to the wall. I sequestered myself inside the stall, Vivian whispering instructions from the other side of the door.
"I think I did it right," I whispered back. "I'm not sure."
"You'd know if you did it wrong." I remained in the stall, humiliated, humbled, and not sure how to feel. Womanhood had officially arrived. The thought filled me with sadness and fear. I began to cry all the tears I had managed to hold back the night before. I couldn't help it. Vivian, of course, heard me and said,
"Are you crying?"
"No."
"You totally are. I'm coming in."
Before I could protest, she was in the stall, closing the door behind her and nudging me aside with her hips so she could join me on the toilet seat. "Come on," she said. "It's not that bad."
"How would you know? You're only, like, 3 years older than me."
"Which is a lifetime, trust me. Just ask your older sister."
"I'm an only child."
"That's a shame," Vivian said. "Big sisters are awesome. At least mine was."
"I always wanted a sister," I said. "One who could teach me things."
"Like how to shove cotton up your twat each month?" I laughed then, in spite of my fear and discomfort. In fact, I laughed so hard I momentarily forgot about both. "That's better," Vivian said. "No more crying. I forbid it. And since I've already gone above and beyond the call of duty here, I'm offering up my services as surrogate big sister. For the next 6 weeks, you can talk to me about any damn thing you want."
"Like boys?"
"Oh, I happen to have lots of experience in that area." She let out a rueful chuckle. "Trust me, Em, they're more trouble than they're worth."
"How much experience?"
"If you're asking if I've had sex, the answer's yes." I shrank away from her, suddenly intimidated. I'd never met a girl who'd done it before.
"You look scandalized," Vivian said.
"But you're only 16.
"Which is old enough."
"Did you like it?"
Vivian flashed a wicked grin.
"Loved it."
"And did you love him?"
"Sometimes it's not about love," she said. "Sometimes it's just about seeing someone and wanting him." I thought of Theo just then. How handsome he was, with muscles in all the right places. How looking at him made me feel deliciously unbalanced. Only in that cramped stall with Vivian did I understand that I had experienced the first flush of desire. The realization almost made me start to cry again. The only thing that stopped me was the sound of the latrine door squeaking open, followed by the slap of flip-flops on the tile floor. Vivian peeked through the crack in the stall door. She turned back to me with wide eyes and mouthed two words. "Holy shit."
"Who is it?"
I mouthed back. Vivian answered in an excited whisper. Theo.
Water began to blast inside a shower stall, the one in the far corner of the latrine. I started to feel dizzy as my brain filled with the same stew of emotions I had felt the night before. Warmth, happiness, shame. I was in the same room with a boy who was showering. No, not a boy, a man. And not just any man, Theo Harris White.
What do we do?
I whispered to Vivian. She didn't answer. Instead, she moved, out of the stall, toward the door, dragging me with her, the two of us incapable of making a silent retreat. Vivian giggled madly. I tripped and slammed a shoulder into the paper towel dispenser.
Halt! Theo called from the shower stall. Who goes there?
Vivian and I exchanged looks. I'm certain mine was deer in headlights panicked. Hers was delighted. It's Vivian, she said coyly, drawing out the end of her name into an extra syllable.
Hey, Viv.
Theo said it so casually that jealousy bloomed in my chest. How lucky Vivian was, to be known by Theo, to be greeted with such easy familiarity. Vivian noticed the envy in my eyes and added,
Emma's here too.
Emma who?
Emma Davis, she's new.
Oh, that Emma. Cool, fashionably late Emma.
I let out a squeak, shocked and elated that Theo knew who I was, that he remembered leading me to Dogwood in the dark of night, that he had noticed me. Vivian elbowed me in the ribs, prompting me to meekly reply, Hi, Theo.
Why are you two up so early?
He asked. I froze, one hand latched onto Vivian's wrist, silently begging her not to tell him the truth. I wasn't sure if a 13-year-old girl could die of embarrassment, but I certainly didn't want to find out.
Going to the bathroom, she replied. The real question is why you're here. Isn't there a shower in the lodge?
The water pressure there sucks, Theo said. Those pipes are ancient, which is why I haul ass out of bed extra early and shower here before any of you girls can stumble in.
We were here first, Vivian says. And I'd be grateful if you'd finally leave so I can shower in peace.
Vivian looked down at me, smirking, and whispered, He means jerk off. It was so dirty and inappropriate that a laugh burst out of me. Theo heard it, of course, and said,
I mean it, guys. I can't stay in here all day.
Fine, Vivian called back. We're gone. We departed in a torrent of giggles, me still clutching Vivian's wrist, the two of us twirling each other in the pre-dawn. We spun until I grew dizzy, and everything, the camp, the latrine, Vivian's face, became a glorious, happy blur. 10. It takes me hours to fall asleep. The silence is once again too oppressive for my Manhattanite ears. When I finally do manage to drift off, my sleep is stormy with bad dreams. In one of them, the most vivid, I see the long-haired woman from the photo found in Vivian's trunk. I stare into those distressed eyes until it dawns on me that it's not a picture I'm looking at, but a mirror. I'm the woman in the photograph. It's my absurdly long hair trailing to the floor, my dark cloud eyes staring back at me. The realization jolts me from sleep. I sit up, my breath heavy and my skin coated in a thin sheen of sweat. I'm also struck by the need to pee, which tugs me reluctantly from bed. Careful not to wake the others, I fumble in the darkness for my flashlight and those newly purchased boots, which I stuff my bare feet into once I'm outside. The flashlight remains off as I indulge myself with a view of the darkened sky above. I'd forgotten how different night is here, clearer than in the city. Unmarred by light pollution and constant air traffic, the sky spreads out like a vast canvas painted midnight blue and studded with stars. The moon sits low on the horizon, already dipping into the forest to the west. It's such a beautiful sight that I get the urge to paint it, which, I suppose, is progress. Inside the latrine, I hit the light switch by the door. Fluorescent bulbs overhead hum to life as I head to the nearest stall. The same stall, coincidentally, where Vivian led me on that fraught, frightening night. To this day, it amazes me how I entered the latrine that night feeling one thing and left feeling the complete opposite. Going in, I was terrified by the ways my body could betray me. I departed, riding a wave of laughter, still clutching Vivian. I remember how happy I was in that moment, how alive I had felt. The memory of that time makes me sigh as I prepare to leave the stall. I'm stopped by the sound of the latrine door being opened. At first, I think it might again be Theo. A sad, silly thought when you get right down to it, but it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility, seeing how we're both back here after all this time. Instead, when I peek through the crack in the stall door, I see a girl. Long, bare limbs, a flash of blonde hair. She stands at the row of sinks along the wall, checking her features in the mirror. I check them, too, shifting slightly in the stall to get a better view of her reflection. I spot dark eyes, a perky nose, a chin that tapers to a point. A gasp leaps from my throat as I push out of the stall, calling her name. Vivian? I know I'm wrong even before the girl at the sink spins around, startled. Her hair's not as blonde as I had thought. Her skin is more tanned. When she fully faces me, I see the diamond stud in her nose, winking at me. Who the hell is Vivian? Miranda asks. No one, I start to say, stopping myself mid-lie. A camper, I knew. Well, you scared the shit out of me. I have no doubt. I scared myself as well. When I look down at my hands, I see I'm clutching the charm bracelet, the birds rattling. I force myself to let go. I'm sorry, I tell Miranda. I'm confused and tired. Can't sleep? I shake my head. You? Same. She says it with forced casualness, which instantly tips me off that it's a lie. I'm good at that kind of thing. I was trained by the best. Is everything okay? Miranda gives me a nod that soon veers into a slow shake of her head. The movement highlights the redness of her eyes and the faint, shimmering lines that run down her cheeks. Tears, recently dried. What happened? I was just dumped, she says. Which is a first, by the way. I do the dumping, always. I go to the sink next to her and turn on the tap. The water rushing from the faucet is blessedly cold. I run a paper towel under the stream and press it to my cheeks and neck. The feeling is delicious. Crisp water against my skin evaporating in the heat, the vanished droplets leaving pinpricks in their wake. Miranda watches me, silently seeking comfort. It occurs to me that's also part of my job, one I'm woefully unprepared for. Yet I know about heartbreak all too well. You want to talk about it? No, Miranda says, but then adds, It's not like we were serious. We'd only dated for, like, a month. And I get it. I'm gone for 6 weeks. He wants to have fun this summer. But he dumped me by text. What kind of jackass does that? One who clearly doesn't deserve you, I say. But I really liked him. More tears glisten at the edges of her eyes. She refuses to let them fall, instead using a fist to wipe them away. It's usually the other way around. Normally, I couldn't care less about guys who really like me. But he was different. You must think I'm, like, such a baby. I think you're hurt, I tell her. But you'll feel better sooner than you think. By the time you get back from camp, he'll be with some skank, Miranda says. Exactly. He'll be with some skank, and you'll wonder why you even liked him in the first place. And he'll regret dumping me. Miranda checks her reflection in the mirror, smiling at what she sees. Because I'm going to look so hot with my camp tan? That's the spirit, I say. Now, go back to the cabin. I'll be there in a minute. Miranda heads to the door, giving me a wiggle finger wave as she goes. Once she's gone, I stay behind to splash more cold water on my face and compose myself. I can't believe I'd momentarily thought she was Vivian. Not a road I want to go down again. Those days are over. No thanks to this place and all these memories that keep returning like a bad habit. When I step outside, even the sky is familiar. A shade of grayish blue that I've used often in my paintings. Muted and melancholy and just the tiniest bit hopeful. It was that same color when Vivian and I bolted from the latrine in the wee hours of the morning, laughing with abandon, the rest of camp sleepy and silent. It had felt like we were the only people on Earth. But there had been a third person also awake, as Vivian soon reminded me. "Come here," she whispered, standing by the latrine, her elbow bent against its cedar wall. "There's something I know you'll want to see." With a grin, she gestured to two planks in the latrine's exterior wall. One was slightly crooked, leaving a crack big enough for light to trickle through it. Occasionally, the light would blink out a moment, blocked by someone on the other side of the wall. That someone was Theo, still in the shower. I heard the rush of water and his faint humming of a Green Day tune. "How do you know about this?" I asked. Vivian grinned from ear to ear. "Found it last year. No one knows about it but me."
"And you want me to spy on Theo?"
"No," Vivian replied. "I dare you to spy on him."
"But it's wrong."
"Go on, take a look. He'll never know." I swallowed hard, my throat suddenly parched. I edged closer to the wall, wanting to get a better look, ashamed by that want. Even more shameful was my need to please Vivian.
"It's fine," Vivian whispered. "When you get an opportunity to look, you're a fool not to take it." So I looked, even though I knew it was wrong. I leaned in and placed an eye to the crack in the wall, at first seeing nothing but steam and the water-speckled shower wall. Then Theo appeared, skin slick, body smooth in some places, matted with dark hair in others. It was the most beautiful, frightening thing I had ever seen. I didn't watch him for very long. After a few seconds, the wrongness of the situation crashed over me, and I turned away, red-faced and dizzy. Vivian stood behind me, shaking her head in such a way that I couldn't tell if she thought I had looked too much or not enough. "Well, how was it?" she asked as we headed back to the cabin.
"Gross," I said.
"Right," she bumped my hip with hers. "Totally gross."
I'm halfway to the cabins when a strange, sudden noise gets my attention. It's a rustling sound, like someone walking through the grass to my left. My thoughts turn instantly to Casey's story about the victims of Lake Midnight. When something appears on the edge of my vision, I think for a split second it's one of the ghosts, ready to drag me to a watery grave. Or one of the rumored survivor's grandsons wielding an axe. I switch on the flashlight and swing it toward the noise. It turns out to be a fox slinking toward the forest. Something is in its mouth, an unknown creature now dead. All I can make out is blood-slicked fur. The fox pauses in the flashlight's glare, its body coiled, eyes glowing greenish-white as it stares at me, deciding if I'm a threat. I'm not. Even the fox can see that. It trots on, unconcerned, a dead limb of whatever's in its mouth flopping as it vanishes into the forest. I, too, resume walking, feeling a little bit frightened and a lot foolish. The mood persists as I reach Dogwood, because that's when I notice something out of the ordinary as I reach for the doorknob. A light, tiny and red, flaring like the tip of a cigarette. It glows from the back wall of the cabin in front of ours, Red oak, I think, or maybe sycamore. I aim the flashlight at it and see a black rectangle tucked into the nook where the two sides of the roof connect. A slim cord drips down the wall to the ground. A surveillance camera, the kind you see in the corners of convenience stores. I turn off the flashlight and stare at the camera's lens, which shimmers slightly in the darkness. I don't move a muscle. The red light snaps off. I wait 5 seconds before waving the flashlight over my head. The red light flicks on again, triggered by the motion. I assume it does this every time someone enters or exits the cabin. I have no idea how long the camera's been doing this, or why it's there, or if there are others scattered throughout the camp. All I know is that Franny, or Theo, or someone involved with Camp Nightingale decided it was a good idea to keep an eye on the cabin. The irony of the situation unsettles me. 15 years later, I'm the one being watched. 11. Inside, I'm unable to go back to sleep. I change into my bathing suit and a brightly patterned silk robe bought during a long-ago trip to Cozumel. I then grab a towel from my trunk and slip quietly out of the cabin. On my way out the door, I will myself not to look at the camera. I don't want to see its red light switch on, nor do I want to face the lens's prying eye. I walk past it quickly, face averted, pretending I don't know it's there, just in case someone is watching. As I make my way to the lake, I sneak glances at the other cabins, checking for cameras on those as well. I don't see any. Nor do I see any on the handful of light poles that dully illuminate the pathway into the heart of the camp, or in the trees. I try not to let that worry me. At the edge of Lake Midnight, I place the towel on the cracked dirt of the shore, drop the robe, and step gingerly into the water. The lake is cold, bracing, not at all like the heated pool at the local Y where I swim each morning. Lake Midnight is murkier. Although the water's only up to my knees, my bare feet look blurred and slightly greenish. When I scoop some into my cupped hands, I see swirling specks of feathery algae. Steeling myself with a deep breath, I dive under, kicking hard, arms extended in front of me. I emerge only when my chest starts to tighten, lungs swelling. I then start to cut my way across the lake. Strands of mist hover just above the surface, breaking apart when I burst through them. In the water, yellow perch flee my path, startled. I stop once I reach the middle of the lake, probably a quarter mile from shore. I have no idea how deep the water is here, maybe 30 feet, maybe 100. I think about how everything below me used to be dry land. A valley filled with trees and rocks and animals. All of it is still down there. The trees rotted by water, the stones fuzzy with algae, the animals stripped of their flesh by fish, now nothing but bones. Not a comforting thought. I think of the story Casey told me. The village still at the bottom of the lake, its skeletal inhabitants tucked in their beds. That's even less comforting. Paddling in place, I turn back toward camp. At this hour, it's quiet and still, bathed in pinkish light from the rising sun that peaks above the mountains to the east. The only activity I see is a solitary figure standing at the dock's edge, watching me. Even from this distance, I know the figure is Becca Schoenfeld. I see the splash of color from the scarf circling her neck and can make out the shape of her camera as she lifts it to her face. Becca remains on the dock as I swim back to shore, her camera poised. I try not to feel self-conscious as the staccato clicks of the shutter echo across the water. Instead, I swim harder, increasing my strokes. If Becca's going to watch, then I'll give her something worth watching. That's another different lesson I learned in this lake. I get to my feet a few yards from shore and wade the rest of the way.
Becca has left the dock and is now directly in front of me, gesturing for me to stop. I indulge her, standing shin deep in the water as she clicks off a few more shots.
Sorry, she says once she's finished. The light was so perfect I couldn't resist. Such a beautiful sunrise.
She holds the camera in front of me as I dry off, scrolling through the photos. Of the last one, she says,
this one's the keeper.
In the picture, I've risen from the lake, water streaming down my body, backlit by the sunrise. I think Becca was going for something fierce and empowering, a woman emerging victorious from the surf, now determined to conquer land. But instead of fierce, I simply look lost, as if I've just woken up in the water, confused by how I'd gotten there. It makes me feel so self-conscious that I quickly reach for my robe and wrap it tight around me. Please delete that.
But it looks great.
Fine, I say. Just promise me it won't end up on the cover of National Geographic. We settle onto the grass and stare out at the water, which reflects the pinkish-orange sky so perfectly it's hard to tell which is which. At least Becca was right about that. The sunrise is indeed beautiful.
So you're an artist, she says. I read about your gallery show.
And I've seen your photographs. Having stated the obvious, we settle into an awkward silence. I pretend to adjust the sleeves of my robe. Becca fiddles with her camera strap. We both keep an eye on the sunrise, which has now gained a few streaks of gold.
I can't believe I'm back here, Becca eventually says. I can't believe you're back here.
You and me both.
Listen, I'm sorry for acting weird yesterday. I saw you in the mess hall and momentarily freaked out. I don't know why.
I do, I say.
Seeing me brought back 100 different memories, some of which you weren't prepared to face.
Exactly.
It happens all the time to me, I admit. Almost nonstop. Everywhere I look, a memory seems to be lurking.
I'm assuming Franny lured you back, Becca says. I nod, even though it's not entirely the truth.
I volunteered, Becca says. I mean, I already knew Franny was going to ask. She somehow managed to track me down during one of my rare returns to New York and invited me to lunch. As soon as she started talking about Camp Nightingale, I knew what she had planned. So I jumped at the chance.
I took a little more convincing. Not me. For the past 3 years, I've been living out of a suitcase. Staying in one place for 6 weeks definitely had its appeal. Becca stretches out on the grass as if to prove how relaxed she truly is.
I don't even mind that I'm bunking with 3 teenagers. It's worth it if I can get a camera into their hands and possibly inspire them. Plus, this feels like a vacation after some of the horrible shit I've seen.
She lifts her chin to the sunrise and closes her eyes. In that light clenching of her eyelids, I can see that she, too, is haunted by the unknown. The only difference between us is that she's returned to Camp Nightingale to forget. I'm here to remember. Yesterday, when I saw you in the mess hall, I wanted to ask you something.
Let me guess, Becca says. It's about that summer.
I give a curt nod.
Do you remember much? About the summer or the...
She doesn't finish her sentence. It's almost like she's afraid to utter that final word.
I'm not.
The disappearance, I say. Did you notice anything strange the night before it happened? Or maybe the morning I realized they were gone? A memory arrives, a bad one. Me at the lake, telling Franny that the girls were missing as other campers gathered around. Becca stood in the crowd, watching it all unfold through her camera, the shutter clicking away.
I remember you, she says, how frantic and scared you were.
Other than that, you don't recall anything out of the ordinary?
Nope.
The word comes out too fast and pitched too high, like a chirp.
Nothing.
And how well did you know the girls in my cabin?
Allison, Natalie, and Vivian?
Yeah, I say.
You had all spent the previous summer here. I thought you might have known them.
I didn't, not really.
Not even Vivian? I think of Becca's warning my first morning at camp. Don't be fooled, she'll turn on you eventually. I thought the two of you might have been friends.
I mean, I knew her, Becca says. Everyone here knew Vivian, and everyone had an opinion.
What was the general consensus?
Honestly, that she was kind of a bitch.
I flinch at her tone. It's so surprisingly harsh that no other reaction is appropriate. Becca sees it happen and says,
I'm sorry, that was cruel.
It was, I say, my voice quiet. I expect Becca to backtrack a bit or maybe offer a better apology. Instead, she doubles down. Squaring her shoulders, she flashes me a hard look and says,
Come on, Emma, you don't need to pretend around me. Vivian doesn't automatically become a good person just because of what happened to her. I mean, you of all people should know that.
She stands and brushes dirt from her shorts. Then she walks away. Slowly, silently, not looking back. I remain where I am, contemplating the two truths Becca just revealed to me. The first is that she's right. Vivian wasn't a good person. Vanishing into thin air doesn't change that. The second is that Becca remembers much more than she'd like to admit. 15 years ago. The beach at Camp Nightingale, a combination of sand and pebbles strewn along a patch of Lake Midnight decades earlier, felt as uncomfortable as it looked. Not even spreading two towels on top of each other could completely dull the prodding of the stones below. Still, I grinned and tried to bear it as I watched waves of campers tiptoe into the water. Although all four of us had changed into our bathing suits, only Natalie and Allison joined the others in the lake. Natalie swam like the natural athlete she was, using hard, long strokes to easily make it to the string of foam buoys marking the area no one was allowed to swim past. Allison was more of a show-off, somersaulting in the water like a synchronized swimmer. I remained on shore, nervous in my modest one-piece swimsuit. Vivian sat behind me, coating my shoulders with Coppertone, its coconut scent sickeningly sweet.
It's criminal how pretty you are, she said.
I don't feel pretty.
But you are, Vivian said. Hasn't your mother ever told you that?
My mother gives me as little attention as possible. Same thing with my dad. Vivian clucked with sympathy.
That sounds just like my parents. I'm surprised I didn't die of neglect as a newborn. But my sister and I learned how to fend for ourselves. She's the one who made me realize how pretty I was. Now I'll do the same for you.
I'm far from pretty.
You are, Vivian insisted, and in a year or two, you'll be gorgeous. I can tell. Do you have a boyfriend back home?
I shook my head, knowing how I was all but invisible to the boys in my neighborhood. I was among the last of the late bloomers, flat as cardboard. No one paid attention to cardboard.
That'll change, Vivian said. You'll snag yourself a hottie like Theo.
She gestured to the lifeguard stand a few feet away, where Theo sat in red swim trunks, the whistle roped around his neck nestled in his chest hair. Every time I looked at him, which was often, I tried not to think about that morning at the latrine, watching him, wanting him. Instead, it was all I could think about.
Why aren't you in the water? He called down to us.
No reason, Vivian said.
I don't know how to swim, I said.
A grin spread across Theo's face.
That's quite a coincidence. One of my goals today is to teach someone.
He hopped down from the lifeguard stand and, before I could protest, took my hand and led me to the water. I paused when my feet touched the mossy rocks at the lake's edge. They were slick, which made me worry that I'd slip and plunge under. The dirty look of the water only heightened my anxiety. Bits of brown stuff floated just below the surface. When some touched my ankle, I recoiled. Theo tightened his grip around my hand.
Relax. A little algae never hurt anyone.
He guided me deeper into the lake, the water rising against me in increments. To my knees, then to my thighs. Soon I was up to my waist, the chill of the water leaving me momentarily breathless. Or maybe it wasn't the water. Maybe it was the way Theo's broad shoulders glowed in the late June sun, or the way his crooked smile widened when I took another unprompted step deeper into the water.
"Awesome, Em," he said. "You're doing great, but you need to relax more. The water is your friend. Let it hold you up."
Without warning, he slid behind me and scooped me up in his arms, one wrapped around my back, the other slid behind my knees. The areas where his skin touched mine became instantly hot, as if electricity coursed through them.
"Close your eyes," he said.
I closed them as he lowered me into the lake until I couldn't tell the difference between his arms and the water. When I opened my eyes, I saw him standing next to me, arms crossed. I was on my own, letting the water hold me up. Theo grinned, his eyes sparkling.
"You, my dear, are floating."
Just then, noise rippled across the lake, splashing, urgent and panicked. A couple of girls in the deep end began to shriek, their arms flapping against the water like ducks unable to take flight. Beyond them, I saw a pair of hands rising and falling from the lake's surface, waving frantically, water flinging off the fingertips. A face poked out of the drink, gasped, slipped back under. Vivian. Theo left my side and surged toward her. Without him near me, I sank into the water, dropping until I hit the lake bed. I began to paddle, guided by instinct more than anything else, clawing at the water until my nose and mouth broke the surface. I continued to paddle and kick until, lo and behold, I was swimming. I kept at it, looking across the water first to Vivian, still flailing, and then to Natalie and Allison, who bobbed in place, frozen with fear, their faces suddenly pale. I watched them watch Theo as he reached Vivian and clamped an arm around her waist. He swam to shore that way, not stopping until both of their backs were on the pebble-specked beach. Vivian coughed once, and a bubble of lake water spurted from her throat. Tears streamed down her crimson cheeks.
I don't know what happened, she said, gasping. I went under and couldn't come up. I thought I was going to die.
You would have if I hadn't been here, Theo said, anger peeking through his exhaustion. Jesus, Viv, I thought you could swim.
Vivian sat up and shook her head, still crying.
I thought I'd try after watching you teach Emma. You made it look so easy.
Standing a few yards away from them was Becca. Her camera hung from her neck even though she was wearing a bathing suit. She clicked off a picture of Vivian sprawled on shore. Then she turned to the lake, picking me out of the crowd of still stunned campers paddling in the water. She smiled and mouthed four words, each of them silent but unmistakable.
I told you so.
12. I remain on the beach until reveille blasts from the ancient speaker atop the mess hall. The music rushes past me and across the lake, its sound skimming the water on its way to the far shore. The first full day of camp has begun. Again. Rather than battle a horde of teenage girls for space in the latrine, I shuffle to the mess hall, shy in my damp robe and clacking flip-flops. It's mostly empty, thank God. Nobody but me and the kitchen workers. One of them, a guy with dark hair and a patchy goatee, checks me out for half a second before turning away. I ignore him and grab a donut, a banana, and a cup of coffee. The banana is consumed quickly, the donut not so much. Each bite brings a flash of Vivian, squinting, her lips pursed. Her disapproving look. I set down the donut, sigh, pick it up, and shove what's left into my mouth. I wash it down with the coffee, pleased with my 15 years too late defiance.
My walk back to Dogwood is spent swimming against the tide of campers making their way to the mess hall. All of them are freshly scrubbed, trailing scents behind them. Baby powder, Noxzema, shampoo that smells like strawberries. One scent cuts through the others. Something thick and flowery. Perfume. But not just any old perfume. Obsession. Vivian wore it, spritzing it on her neck and wrists twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. The scent used to fill the cabin, lingering there long after she had departed. Now I get that same feeling, like she's just been here, leaving only her scent behind. I spin among the stream of girls, searching for her in the departing crowd, knowing she's not there, but looking anyway. I reach for my bracelet and tap a pewter beak, just in case. The girls surge forward, taking the perfume scent with them. Left behind is a clammy sensation on the back of my neck. It makes me shiver as I stop into Dogwood to grab my clothes for the day. I sniff the air for traces of perfume, detecting nothing but the tang of someone's deodorant. In the latrine, I spot Miranda, Crystal, and Sasha amid the morning stragglers at the sinks. Miranda stares in the mirror, fussing with her hair. Beside her, Sasha says, "Can we go now? I'm starving." "Just a second." Miranda gives her hair one last flip. "There. Now we may go." I give them a wave on my way to the shower stalls, all but one of which are in use. The empty stall is the last one in the row. Like the others, it's a cubicle of cedar walls and a door of smoked glass. A pinpoint of white light glows in the center of that door. Behind me, a similar light peeks through a crack in the cedar wall. Alarm flares in my chest, calming a second later once I understand what's happening. The white glow is sunlight. Its source is a minuscule crack in the shower wall. The same crack I peered through to spy on Theo 15 years ago. I let out a breath, feeling both foolish for not realizing it sooner and relieved that it's not something worse, like another camera. One is enough to make me seriously paranoid. So much so that I consider waiting for another stall to open up. I decide against it for the simple reason that I'm already inside this one with the water running, and thanks to a morning of heavy use, it's not getting any warmer. Besides, Vivian was the only person who knew about that crack. She told me so herself. So I stay where I am, showering as fast as possible. I give my hair a quick shampoo and an even quicker rinse, closing my eyes as the soapy water cascades down my face. I enjoy that moment of temporary blindness. It allows me to pretend, just for a moment, that I'm 13 again and experiencing Camp Nightingale for the very first time. That Vivian, Natalie, and Allison are safe within the confines of Dogwood. That the events of 15 years ago never happened. It's a nice feeling. One that makes me want to linger under the shower spray. But the water keeps getting colder, turning from lukewarm to the wrong side of chilly. In a minute or two, it'll be as cold as Lake Midnight. I finish rinsing my hair and open my eyes. The point of light on the door is gone. I spin around, frantically checking the shower wall behind me. No light peeks through the crack. It's gone, eclipsed by something outside. No, not something. Someone. Right on the other side of the wall. Watching me. I yelp and rush to the door, fumbling for my towel and robe in the process. By the time I'm pushing my way out of the stall, the light has reappeared, both through the wall and onto the door as it swings open. Whoever was there is now gone. That doesn't stop me from yanking on my robe and clutching it tight around me. I rush through the now empty latrine, bursting through the door with the hope of catching whoever had been watching me. No one is outside. The entire vicinity is deserted. The closest people I see are two campers more than 100 yards away. Late for breakfast, they hurry to the mess hall, ponytails bobbing. I'm the only one here. Just to be safe, I do a quick, awkward circle around the building, seeing nothing.
By the time I'm back at the latrine door, I start to wonder if I'm mistaken, and that what I saw was merely someone leaning against the building, obliviously covering the crack in the wall. Yet that explanation doesn't quite make sense. If it had been unintentional, then the person responsible wouldn't have left the moment I realized they were there. They would be here still, no doubt wondering why I've rushed outside, dripping wet, soap remnants sticky on my skin. So I think of other possibilities. A low-flying bird swooping past the latrine, or maybe those late-for-breakfast campers rushing by. There's even a chance it might not have been anything at all. I tried to estimate how long the light through the crack was blocked. Not long, a fraction of a second at most. My eyes had been closed a lot longer than that. When I opened them again, it would have taken a second or two for them to adjust to the dimness of the shower stall. Maybe that's all it was, my vision catching up to reality. By the time I'm back at Dogwood, I've concluded that's what it was, a trick of the light, a brief optical illusion. At least that's what I force myself to believe. Lying to myself, it's the only falsehood I allow. The first painting lesson of the summer is held outside, away from the Arts and Crafts building and its crowd of campers. Despite reassuring myself that it never happened, I remain shaken by my experience in the shower. Paranoia clings to me like cold sweat, making me hyper-alert to even the briefest of glances. When Sasha suggests we paint the lake, I embrace the idea. It temporarily soothes my anxiety, while giving the dozen girls who arrived for the lesson something better to paint than the still life I had planned. Now they stand at their easels, which have been carried to the lawn behind the lodge facing the lake. Palettes in hand, all of them contemplate their blank canvases. Slightly nervous, fingers absently fiddling with the brushes poking from their cargo shorts. I'm nervous, too, and not just from the stress of the morning. The way the girls stare at me, seeking guidance, is intimidating. Mark was right. This is definitely not in my wheelhouse. It helps slightly that the girls from Dogwood are here, including Crystal with her promised sketch pad and a set of charcoal pencils. They're familiar enough to give me a boost of confidence before I begin. The assignment this morning is to paint what you see, I announce. Just look out at the lake and paint it as only you see it. Use whatever colors you want. Use any techniques you want. This isn't school. You won't be graded. The only person you need to please is you. As the girls paint, I walk behind them, checking their progress. Watching them paint calms me. Some, such as Sasha and her meticulously clean lines, even show promise. Others, like Miranda's defiantly blue brushstrokes, do not. But at least they're painting, which is more than I've done for the past 6 months. When I reach Crystal, I see that she's sketched a superhero in tight spandex and a flowing cape standing before an easel. The hero's face is my own. Her muscular body most definitely is not. I think I'm going to name her Monet, Crystal says. Painter by day, crime fighter by night. What's her superpower? I haven't decided yet. I'm sure you'll think of something. Class ends when a bell clangs from the mess hall, signaling lunchtime. The girls put down their brushes and scurry off, leaving me alone to gather up their canvases and easels. I move the canvases first, carrying them back to the Arts and Crafts building two by two so as not to smudge the still wet paint. Then I return for the easels, finding them already in the process of being collected. The gatherer is the maintenance man I saw fixing the roof of the Arts and Crafts building when I arrived. He's come from the tool shed on the edge of the lawn. Its door sits open, offering a glimpse of a lawnmower, a handsaw, chains hanging on the wall. I figured you could use some help, he says. His voice is gruff, thickened by a trace of Maine accent. Thanks, I hold out my hand. I'm Emma, by the way. Instead of shaking my hand, the man nods and says, I know. He doesn't tell me how he knows this, He doesn't need to. He was here 15 years ago. He knows the score.
You were here before, right? I say. I recognized you when I arrived.
The man folds another easel, drops it onto a growing pile.